You're listening to WNJC 1360, Washington Township.
I'm on the air.
You're on. Sorry about that.
Okay. This is the Rob Cole Bottom Up Radio Show. On a minute faster than I expected.
You're good. No, you know what? We had called in. Hey, go ahead. Do yourself.
Okay. So, it's been an interesting week. Big news tonight. Harry Reid has given us a gift. A wonderful gift of healthcare. It's actually regifting, though, because it's really it's a gift that they gave to the health insurance companies. And what they're giving us is the opportunity to make the health insurance companies that much more wealthy. And they're not giving us hardly anything, actually. They're giving us the big pile of, as the French would say, merde, garbage. Now, they're going to say, oh, this is wonderful. Now, you know, if you're just listening in, this is the Rob Cole Bottom Up Radio Show. It's a progressive left of liberal show, and I'm not happy with what the Democrats in the House or the Senate have offered us. It's just junk. It's been whittled down and negotiated so that what's there is a joke. And it's going to take 4 years to deliver this joke to us. By then, we'll know that it's a ripoff, and then we'll have to wait until, you know, there's another abominable Republican in there so the Democrats can get back in power and screw us again. Yeah, you know, it's what they call it, a duopoly. You know, the Republicans and the Democrats are the same party, really, underneath it all. So that's what we have. So tonight, we've got a great show lined up. I'm really excited about. We've got Jeff Charlotte. Jeff has become a regular guest on MSNBC, particularly the Rachel Maddow Show, talking about his book that he's an expert on, The Family. The Family is a house in Washington on K Street where fundamentalist, ultra-conservative right-wingers go to live together. And it's kind of like a cult. So we're going to learn all about it here. What I need to do now is tell you about our sponsor. The Rob Cole Bottom Up Radio Show is sponsored by Za Restaurant. That's zarestaurants.com and HopewellValleyVineyard.com. It's kind of a team effort. You go to the vineyard, do a wine tasting, buy a bottle of wine, go to the Za Restaurant, and have a meal for two, and when you're done, you get a $25 gift certificate. I've been there. It's fabulous. The vineyard is gorgeous. The wine is extraordinary, and the food at the Zai restaurant is exceptional. And well worth the ride from South Jersey or Philadelphia up to Pennington, just south of Princeton. It's a beautiful area up there, and just hop on 95, and you'll be there in no time. Check it out, zarestaurants.com and hopewellvineyards.com. So, in a couple minutes, we're going to have Jeff Charlotte on. I've been in a kind of a ranting mood lately, and I've actually apologized for a little bit. I wrote a piece the other day suggesting that my readers tell the Congress to go to H-E-double. Because the legislation that they've handed us is just so worthless. It's an insult. It's a big, huge, giant gift, a wet kiss to the insurance industry. The health insurers are going to make a fortune on it with all these people who are required to have health insurance. That's going to just go through the roof in price. We found out this week that the pharmaceutical companies, which agreed to give back about $8 billion a year, they made a really nice deal with Obama, brilliant Obama. Well, they ended up raising their prices $9 or $10 billion, so gee whiz, they're going to give back $8 billion. How does that work? What it works as is they reneged on their deal, and the Congress and Obama should stick it to them so hard that they got their tails between their legs, and they'll never, ever try anything like that again. You know, last week I had Bernie Sanders on, and he talked about how he's pushing for legislation to identify the financial companies that are too big to fail and then to break them up. Well, I don't think that it's a good idea to just do it with financial companies. We should be doing it with media companies and every company that's out there that's too big. Big is bad. You know, used to be this theory that there were economies of scale, you know, like Henry Ford developed with his Model T. Well, that's 100 years ago. Do I hear Jeff on the phone?
Yeah, here I am.
You're there. Great. Oh, well, I don't know if you're the one ranting, then. We can talk. Sorry to keep you waiting there.
Not at all. Just got on. Good to be here, Rob.
Good. Well, it's a pleasure. So you have been through this is Jeff Charlotte. Jeff wrote the book, The Family, and I think it's changed your life a little bit, eh?
Well, I mean, it changed my life back when I began writing this book, when I stumbled onto this sort of very secretive and powerful religious organization in Washington and became a member and then decided to write a book about it and spent 5 years, never really anticipated spending that much time with Christian fundamentalism, but I did, and this past summer the book really got some traction and got some attention because of the scandals at the C Street House, which was at the heart of the affairs of Senator John Ensign, Governor Mark Sanford, Congressman Chip Pickering, now in the news again because of the Stupak Pitts connection, both of them very involved with the C Street and the family.
One of those is a relatively local guy. You're talking about Joe Pitts?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
Congressman
just
Joe
down the
Pitts
road. He's just down the road in Lancaster.
Yeah, well, he's got a real prize there. He's been involved with the family since at least 1976. What happened was I went and I lived with this group for a month. Originally wrote about that in Harper's Magazine, then expanded the story in the first chapter of the book. Then I went and I discovered that they had dumped 600 boxes of documents in the Billy Graham Center archives in Wheaton, Illinois. And I just moved out to Wheaton and immersed myself in those archives. And Joe Pitts was just one of the many, many, many characters I found in there, dating back to 1976 and into the 80s when he was a state legislator and a leader of the anti-abortion movement, and the guy who actually really brought anti-abortion politics into this old and influential network of elite Christian conservatives. This is not the folks you see on TV, not the pulpit pounders or the Bible thumpers, but insiders, Washingtonians, inside the Beltway types. And Joe Pitts brought that in and is now what they call a core member of the family. He is one of the guys who is, in effect, sort of setting policy.
Well, take a step back. Describe a little bit more about the family. Now, you did your stay there quite a few years ago, right?
Yeah. I began in 2001 is when the story really began, when a friend said she was worried that her brother joined the cult. And because I write a lot about religion, I was writing my first book about religion at the time, said, "Well, get to talk to this guy." And I did, and he said, "I'd known this guy for many years." He says, "Look, the only way you can understand what I'm involved in is to come see it for yourself." So I did, and you know, At the time, I didn't know it was really a political movement. I wasn't looking to write about a political religion, but really quickly encountered their relationship to politics. I met Senator John Ensign while I was there. Senator Jesse Helms came by for a visit. We had international leaders stopping by, and really saw that this was a political thing. So that was just the beginning. The real work of the book was spending years in archives around the country, interviewing folks, going and talking to current and former members, just digging every which way I could, and immersing myself in the whole history of the organization, which is the oldest and most influential Christian right group in America, going all the way back to the 1930s.
1930s, that brings up, to my mind, the time of Father Coughlin. Was any connection with him, or is he just a straight Catholic?
The group began as a virulently anti-Catholic organization. So, they weren't too keen on Father Coughlin. And Father Coughlin, who was the famous radio priest, for listeners out there, the famous radio priest who began as a great supporter of Franklin Roosevelt and ended as a great enemy of Franklin Roosevelt and an advocate of fascism. But he was always...
And Hitler.
But he was always, whether he was on the left or the right, he was a populist. And the family, and I think what makes them significant then and now, is that they're always an elite organization. They're a different kind of fundamentalism that most of us are familiar with. I think when we think of fundamentalism, we tend to think of, as the Washington Post famously put it, or infamously put it, largely rural, uneducated, poor, and easily led. Well, that certainly does not describe the family, which began in 1935 as a group of Northwestern businessmen who combined their money and their resources to elect a governor of the state of Washington, and on the strength of that success, moved across the country to the other Washington, teamed up with the National Association of Manufacturers, and began recruiting congressmen, all on the principle that God doesn't really care about the souls of the masses. They're not going to do a radio show because God doesn't care about those. I mean, he wants those people to be okay, but they believe that God came to them with a revelation in 1935 saying that Christianity had been getting it wrong for 2,000 years, focusing on the poor and the down and out and the weak. With God, with the people God cared about, so they think he told them in 1935, are those whom he called the up and out. The men like Henry Ford, to whom the leader of the group had been ministering, and later the congressmen and the businessmen that became the spine and the core of the organization.
Henry Ford was connected to it, eh? Wow.
Yeah. Well, Henry Ford was involved with a lot of the right-wing activism at the time. You see all the familiar faces of the elite right back then. Charles Lindbergh led a family prayer cell. A guy who's forgotten, Merwin K. Hart. But again,
hello?
He... Rob, do I have you?
Yeah, we're there. Good.
What they were really doing was looking for businessmen. The group began, again, they're different than the fundamentals we're familiar with because they emphasize the two core principles aren't social issues or anything like that. The principles are economics and foreign affairs, what they would later call biblical capitalism, the idea that the Great Depression was a punishment from God for American disobedience. So all economic suffering is directly related to how we as a nation obey God or disobey God, and that the answer to economic suffering is deregulation. The family has for its entire history, been champions of privatization, and even now as we look at health care reform and some of the prominent family members who are involved, not just Joe Pitts and Stu Pack, but Senator Chuck Grassley, Senator Mike Enzi, these guys who would like to deregulate and put all of our sort of economic decisions in the hands of business elites.
And this is biblical economics?
They call it biblical capitalism. Some in the group call it biblical capitalism. It came from this idea. It's a sort of, a good way to think of it is sort of trickle-down fundamentalism. This is the idea that God puts a few people in positions of power, whether it's in business or in politics, and bestows blessings upon them, which they then pass down to us. I mean, the family began as an anti-union organization. That's what they, that was their first mission, was breaking up unions. The first big piece of legislation that they really threw their muscle behind was something called the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, which rolled back a lot of the gains of the New Deal. And when we ask ourselves, how come the United States alone in the developed world doesn't have a strong organized labor movement? You got to look at Taft-Hartley. And when you ask yourself, how come the United States alone in the developed world doesn't have a serious universal health system, I think you also have to go look back at those mid-century attempts to roll back the New Deal, from which, in a lot of ways, the country never recovered. That's biblical capitalism in action.
Well, you talk about trickle-down religion. You know, I call my show the bottom-up radio show because I believe that we're in the middle of a bottom-up revolution replacing a top-down world, and it sounds like this is the ultimate in top-down religion. These are elites who don't care about we the people, and who do they care about? What are their values? What do they stand for, and who are they trying to take care of?
Well, as I said when I was living with them, you know, they'll still talk about this now. They said there's so many people who are looking out for the down and out. Who's caring for the up and out? That's what they call the powerful. They say
up and out.
The up and out. They say, you know, it's misunderstood. People misunderstand Christ's message. It wasn't meant for the masses. He gave the masses parables. The real teachings was an inner circle. The masses can't understand that, and that's why the group has a sort of secretive policy. You know, they describe themselves as an invisible organization. There's actually a sermon that's now been put online that you can see, you can listen to, with Doug Coe, the longtime leader, saying, the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have. We've seen this, I think, in the last year with the attention on C Street. Last year, I teamed up with NBC Nightly News to do a segment on the group. NBC News called one of the leaders to talk to him about it, and he immediately said, oh, no, there's a terrible mistake. There's no organization here, no organization at all, just a group of friends. Well, fortunately, NBC had done their homework and had gone over the extensive tax records of this organization, seen the interlocking nonprofits, the ways in which the group acts in its own words. This is its own description for itself. I'm not casting aspersions. They call themselves a Christian mafia through these sort of interlocking organizations that don't really leave a paper trail. All this kind of culture of secrecy because they think politics should happen behind closed doors. They say what they do is they create space for God-chosen elites to meet and work together. They use this pretentious little Latin phrase, beyond the din of the vox populi. What that means is beyond the voice of the people. And I think a perfect example is the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. Bart Stupak has been living at the family's C Street house for 7 years. This is a townhouse on Capitol Hill that they own. It's one of many properties that they own. Registered as a church, tax-exempt, they provide below-market housing to congressmen, and sort of constant prayer sessions and so on. Bart Stupak's been living there for 7 years. Joe Pitts is one of the core members of the group. They've teamed up before on extremely reactionary legislation, and they did so again on the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, which is the greatest rollback of reproductive rights in a generation, and they really did so behind closed doors. There's just no way to view that amendment as democratic. They did some arm twisting and some moving around behind closed doors. Now, they weren't the only group with a stake in that fight, but they are an important one. They are a nexus on Capitol Hill. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, far-right Republican and longtime member of the group, he says, look, the House on C Street provides us a place to do policy meetings. It provides us a place to get together and sort of get our marching orders. As he describes it in one video, that you can also find online. He now travels the world on the tab of the taxpayers' tab, U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. And what he's doing, and I'm quoting here, he says, I promote the political philosophy of Jesus, the political philosophy of Jesus, as taught to me by the family. You know, this is so far beyond the line of separation between church and state that it borders on treason.
How many members of Congress would you say are a part of the family?
Well, the family holds, I should say that they view membership in sort of a series of concentric rings. There's folks at the core like Joe Pitts, Senator Sam Brownback, Senator James Inhofe, very involved. And then there's those who are maybe a little less involved. Congressman Heath Shuler, very conservative Democrat from North Carolina, who lives at the C Street House. And then there are those who are even a little bit less involved. Senator Mark Pryor, another Democrat. He's pro-war, anti-labor, anti-gay, creationist, but he's a Democrat down there in Arkansas, and he's at a sort of a further remove. When you talk about the core, you're talking about maybe a dozen. When you talk about the sort of the slightly larger ring, you're talking about 20 or 30. And when you talk about the folks who have some level of regular, weekly, or biweekly involvement, you're talking about 40 or 50 congressmen. And then when you talk about the folks with whom that they have relationships, one of those that I write about in the book is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton describes the leader of the group, Doug Coe, as a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. She talks about how when she first came to Washington, 1993, she turned to them and they set up a prayer cell of right-wing women, Jack Kemp's wife, Jim Baker's wife, various corporate wives, to guide her spiritually. She's no stealth fundamentalist, but I think she recognized that this group is so entrenched at the nexus of religion and politics in Washington that you kind of have to have a relationship with them if you're going to do religion and politics in Washington.
It's frightening. It really is. So when you say there are 40 or 50, is that 40 or 50 of that level, or plus the 20, plus the 10, or 40 or 50 altogether?
I think you have about 40 or 50 who have a regular relationship, including the core. But I mean, we're talking about some powerful people.
We're talking about 10%, almost 10% of the whole Congress.
Have a serious relationship with this organization. That doesn't mean all of them. Look, the core teachings of the group are absolutely frightening. I sat in on a spiritual counseling session between Doug Coe, the leader, and Congressman Todd Tehart, the Republican from Kansas. Todd Tehart came in with a standard sort of list of issues that Christian conservatives care about, abortion, Islam. He's against them both. And Doug Coe urged him to think a little bigger, think a little bit deeper. He says, what does Jesus have to say about Social Security? What does Jesus have to say about building roads? The answer for the family is always the same. It's privatized. But then he says, look, what I'm really trying to get at is I want you to think bigger. I don't want you to think according to issues. I want you to think according to power. And he offers the congressman a list of men who have wielded power like Jesus. Now, he'll say, look, before I give you this list, he'll say these are evil men, but they understand power, and we want to emulate them. The list is Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin, Lenin, even puts Osama bin Laden on this list. And when I first heard that, I thought, boy, that was just a stunningly poor choice of words. But over the years, researching and their documents, hearing more and more, that's actually at the heart of their teachings. In fact, you can find, for NBC, we got a hold of some video of Doug Coe teaching about the political fellowship that he tries to organize politicians into is like the great friendship enjoyed by Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmlers, and other audio sermons that a blogger and activist named Bruce Wilson located. You can hear him talking about, you know how Jesus, and I'm quoting here, says, you know how Jesus taught you have to put Jesus before your mother, father, brother, sister? Well, that's what Hitler and Mao taught the kids. Mao even had the kids killing their own parents. Remember, I'm quoting, this is the man whom Hillary Clinton calls a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and God. Mao even had the kids killing their own parents, but it wasn't murder, you see, because it was for building the new nation. It was for building the kingdom.
Who is this guy?
Doug Coe, he he came up in the sort of the parachurch world, as it's called, parachurch ministries, with a group called the Navigators, and a group called Young Life, and proved himself a very effective organizer out in Oregon, and moved to Washington in 1959. He was a protege of a major Christian right figure of the early 20th century named Dawson Trotman. Moved to Washington in 1959. One of the first jobs he got involved in with the family was the relationship with Haiti. And one of the stories I tell in the book is 1959, two senators at the time, Senator Frank Carlson, very powerful senator from Kansas, and Senator Homer Capehart of Indiana, led a delegation of American businessmen to Haiti to interview a leader who they saw as a promising prospect for American support. They liked the man. They came back. They wrote up a report saying that he was a man of God chosen for Haiti. They used their position on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee to become sort of champions for this leader, and to begin the long and complex and horrifying American relationship with Papa Doc Duvalier, perhaps one of the most lunatic killers in the Western Hemisphere. With Doug Coe, that was his first project, and on the strength of that, he sort of rose in the organization. When the founder died in 1969, or as they put it, was promoted to heaven, that's their language, Doug Coe took over. And he was much more secretive than the founder. He was the guy who said, look, we're going to deny that we're an organization. Found a letter in the archives that he sent out to all the members. This is the time has come to submerge. This is a memo sent to congressmen saying now when you take activity as part of this organization, don't use family letterhead. Use your own letterhead so it appears as if it's a congressional action. And even now, the family holds one public event every year, the National Prayer Breakfast, which they created in 1953. The president always speaks. Most of Congress is there. Foreign leaders come from around the world. Nobody really knows who's organizing things. The event itself is very ecumenical, bland. It's surrounded by a week of lobbying fest. If you get invited, your invitation comes on congressional letterhead. If you go as a reporter like I did, you RSVP through the White House. And yet the internal planning documents that you can go and see for yourself, well, one document says anything can happen at the National Prayer Breakfast. Even the Quran can be read. But Jesus is there. He is infiltrating the world. And this is what they have put, they've put American government support behind this. They've used it as a way of building power, as a way of building relationships, and frankly of, I think, subverting the democratic will of the people.
This is like a novel. This is like a made-up fictional story that is like a horror story.
I should emphasize that it is hard to believe, and that's why that's why as I've been going along here, I've been telling you, you want to see a video of Doug Coe talking about Hitler, Goebbels, Himmler, Google my name and NBC, you'll find the video.
What is remarkable to me is you've repeatedly talked about the documentation that you studied and that you found. So even though they wanted to submerge, they've kept copious records that are publicly available?
Yeah, well, I should say, the interesting thing about the family is they are not secret. They're secretive. And what they did was they dumped 600 boxes, hundreds of hours of tape, and the Billy Graham Center archives in Wheaton, Illinois. And I don't think they ever thought anyone would particularly look at them. You have to remember, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. They think they're doing God's work. They think that when people see what they're doing, they'll love it. No one really had looked at it before I got there. There's only one other reporter who had dug through those archives, a woman named Lisa Getter for the Los Angeles Times, who did a terrific expose in 2002, noting that the family had been the middlemen in between the Reagan White House and Central American death squads, that they had been played a role in various political scandals. Should have been A1. She spent A1 on the L.A. Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, spent a year in this investigation, should have been big news, and it just got no traction. Then I came along and started digging through those archives. They're all there, and that's why in my book, The Family, it's published by HarperCollins, but I insisted that we use a kind of a scholarly apparatus. I'm a research scholar at New York University Center for Religion and Media, so I've got one foot in that world, because I want to have all those footnotes there. When I cite a document, I give you folder number, box number, and collection number. You can go and look at that document for yourself. And I think that's very important because, of course, a lot of people are going to push back and say, I'm making this stuff up or it's a conspiracy theory. Well,
it's incredible. Let me just do a station ID. This is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360, reaching Metro Philly in South Jersey. And I'm talking with Jeff Charlotte, the author of the book, The Family, which is an expose of a cult that composes 10% of the members of Congress. Incredible story here. I was talking to a friend getting ready to do the show, and I was saying that I was going to talk to you, and he goes, have you checked this guy out? I mean, is this supported? And you've got it documented to the box. It's incredible.
Because the listeners may not be familiar with me, and usually it's sort of part of the introduction. Look, I've had an academic affiliation at New York University. I've been for years a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone Magazine. I've written for The New Republic, The Nation, The Washington Post, a lot of mainstream publications. Everything I do gets fact-checked. Much of it goes through legal vetting. The Family has had every single opportunity possible to rebut me. I've gotten, support from mainstream media organizations like NBC Nightly News. NBC Nightly News, they did find a guy to speak up for The Family. And they asked him about the sort of Hitler rhetoric that we saw on the videotape. And his answer was that it was just a metaphor. The Hitler was just a metaphor for Jesus, at which point you want to say, well, you can't think of a better metaphor for Jesus than
really
Hitler. How about a lion or a lamb or something? I think there's something else. But the reality is it's not just a metaphor, because when we look historically, I gave you that example of Papa Doc Duvalier, but that created a model that they then replicated again and again throughout developing nations. 1965, 66, the Indonesian dictator Suharto came to power with a coup. Even the CIA called, and I quote, one of the worst mass killings of the 20th century. The Family in their documents called it a spiritual revolution, began sending delegations of congressmen and oil executives over to oil-rich Indonesia to meet with Suharto, who was a Muslim, but was willing to pray to Jesus with these Americans in exchange for massive military aid. The military aid, of course, that we know that he turned on his own people in East Timor and around Indonesia. By the end of his regime, he'd killed 1.2 million of his own citizens. The Family said he was chosen by God. And again, that story replicates itself. In Brazil, they threw their legislative lobbying muscle behind the junta of generals who took over that country, steering it away from democracy. They became the chief champions, the chief congressional champions of American support. United States ended up giving billions of dollars to these generals. Another country that's been in the news a lot lately is Somalia. We don't think of Somalia as strategically important, but of course it is. It's a haven for Al-Qaeda. It's a base for piracy. And it's really very strategically located. It was an important piece in the Cold War. One of the stories I tell in some depth in the book, because it was so well documented and because it involves a politician who's still in office today, Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, was the Family reaching out to the dictator of that nation, Saad Barre, another lunatic, a man who described himself as a Quranic Marxist. Didn't seem like a likely candidate for Christian right recruitment, but he was very clear about what he was in it for. In a letter he wrote to the Family, he says, I'll pray to Jesus, but in return I want three things. I want my defense budget doubled. I want meetings with the White House, and I want a U.S. hands-off policy while I crack down on some rebel groups in the North. And we look at the history books, we look at the archives. Done, done, and done. The Family organized a meeting for his defense minister with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Vesey. This is documented again. We can go back and look at this. The defense budget was nearly doubled, and the United States didn't say a word as he cracked down on the rebels in the North, and then in the South, and then in the West, and then in the East, waging a war of biblical proportion on his own people, which the family to this day says was part of God's plan.
Now, you mentioned Reagan. How about Bush and Cheney and Herbert Walker Bush? Did they have any ties to the family?
Bush Sr. was actually a little bit closer in the archives. I was sort of stunned upon. Bush Sr. used the family's headquarters as a C Street ministry in Capitol Hill, but the real headquarters is a $4.5 million mansion out in Arlington called the Cedars. Beautiful property at the end of a cul-de-sac surrounded by houses that are owned by family members. Ed Meese, former Reagan Attorney General, holds a weekly meeting there. Various other politicians do. And Bush used it in the 80s. I verified this in several different archives, to hold meetings with Iraqi officials over the Iraqi oil pipeline, which Ed Meese, some may remember, was the Attorney General who was sort of infamous for his pornography commission. People forget that he had to resign in an ethics scandal because he was helping Saddam Hussein win oil contracts. That's the Reagan administration. And Bush Sr. was part of that. Bush Sr. at the 1990 or 91 prayer breakfast praised the leader of Doug Coe. He says, "I want to praise him for what," he said, "well, I wouldn't quite call it secret diplomacy. I would call it quiet diplomacy." Bush Sr. was apparently unaware of one of the oldest laws on the books, the Logan Act, which forbids diplomacy by private citizens because they're not accountable to the people who elect them. And yet Bush seemed to think that was a good idea. Now, the Bush II administration is a little more complicated. Bush II, he had a relationship with them, but not nearly as close. He comes out of a more populist fundamentalist background. Cheney, same deal. Cheney, you know, there's a few politicians in American history who really don't even need a veneer of piety to do what they're doing. I don't think Cheney needed to tell himself he was doing God's work. I think he knows what he's up to. But the administration was filled. It was a good time for the family because of so many folks who were affiliated with the family, like John Ashcroft, who first got involved in the 1980s when he wrote to Doug Coe saying, the young Missouri politician says, "I want to infiltrate Jesus into a government. Can you help me?" And Doug Coe did, and Ashcroft helped him when he got in there. The whole faith-based initiatives project was something the family had been working on literally for decades, and you can trace the whole intellectual and ideological development of it in the family's archives. So it was a lot of great successes. And I should say, they still have some folks out there now. They've been around for 70 years because they don't attach themselves solely to Republican administrations. There's always some Democrats involved.
So when Clinton was president for 8 years, were there Democrats in there as well? And who would they be?
Oh, well, Hillary Clinton, by her, she, again, this is really easy to document. She writes about it in her book. She had a pretty long and extensive relationship with Doug Coe, the leader of the group. I don't think she ever, I know she never heard this extreme rhetoric about modeling yourself on Hitler and all this kind of crazy stuff, but she did have this relationship with the group. And in fact, when we look back at faith-based initiatives, for instance, I think a lot of liberals want to put that on Bush's doorstep, and that's really not the case. That's Clinton-era legislation that made that possible. That's the charitable choice legislation of the late 90s. And those were Clinton regulatory changes. And certainly, there were a lot of other sort of erosion of church-state policies in the Clinton years that I think sort of laid the groundwork for where we're at today. They didn't have a whole lot of high-up officials in the Clinton administration, but the other thing that the family's done, and this is sort of in some ways a model of how Christian right organizes and why they tend to beat the left, is that they understand that there are, it's not just the top offices that are important. They understand that, look, if we can get a lot of people into Health and Human Services, as they did during the Clinton administration, or into the Education Department, lifers, civil servants who are going to be there, who are going to be part of our ideological program, we can really affect the changes that we believe in. That's been the Christian right model, for decades. You go back to the more populist Christian right, Jerry Falwell, in the 1970s. Everyone's got their eyes on the prize, the White House, the big issues. Christian Wright thing, you know what? If we win PTAs, and then we win city council elections, and then we win state legislature elections, we can build real lasting power, and eventually we'll get our guy in the White House. And of course, they did in 2000.
So, Jeff, this is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio, WNJC 1360. I'm talking to Jeff Charlotte, the author of the book The Family, which describes a cult which could be the most powerful organization in America. Now, you've said that there are 40 to 50 members of Congress, about 10% of the Congress, that are a part of this cult. But from what you're describing, there could be thousands or tens of thousands of other people who are involved in it. And you also talked about how there are major leaders of other countries connected to it. How many people do you think are involved in the United States and worldwide? Do you have any idea?
No, well, it's not, again, remember, it's not a mass organization. They don't want huge numbers. Chuck Colson, some people may remember Chuck Colson from Watergate. He was one of the Watergate felons, reinvented as a Christian right leader and is one of the very most powerful Christian right leaders in the United States. He came to Christ through the family process he describes in his book, Born Again. He describes joining the family. He says, I discovered, and I quote, a veritable underground of God's men all through government. He estimated the worldwide sort of membership at about 20,000. Now, there's a sociologist down at Rice University named D. Michael Lindsay, conservative, evangelical sociologist, but a good scholar, and he did a study for Oxford University Press. He estimates about 350 full-time paid associates of the family. That's a small number. But you have to remember that a lot of this stuff is taking place off the books. They're organizing folks at all levels of government. Now, the one thing, though, that I would say, I don't call it a cult. And I think that's important for us to remember. It's not a cult and it's not a conspiracy. It's a social movement. What they're doing is ultimately, for the most part, not illegal. And the way we can combat it is not by saying, well, we got to kick down the doors with the police and shine the light on it. We got to say, hey, they've created an anti-democratic culture. The way we fight back is with a democratic culture. That we don't assume that democracy is something that is given to us or something we just live in, but it's something we make every day that we engage with our politicians democratically. I look at Bart Stupak, responsible for this terrible anti-abortion amendment that he worked on in part through the family. And Bart Stupak makes a brief appearance in the book and doing some more writing about him now. You can see a piece on Salam, actually, that I wrote about Stupak, Pitts Amendment. You know, you look at Bart Stupak, after he does this thing, he goes back to Michigan, he does a town hall, and what I thought was terrific was someone who had read the book, The Family, went to the town hall and said, well, look, here's the documentation. I want to know about your relationship to this group, and can you explain what it is? Put them on the hot seat. That's how you fight back. We don't need to call them a cult. We don't need to call them a conspiracy. We just need to ask tough questions. And, you know, that's good news.
What kind of questions would somebody ask if they know that their legislator is a member of the family and has participated? If somebody's representative is Joe Pitts or Charles Grassley, what would they say to them? How would you? What would be like a sample script that you would recommend?
Well, I think a great example would be Senator Sam Brownback, who's a longtime member of the group, and I write a lot about him in the book. He gave me terrific access. Spent time with him in Washington and back home in Topeka, and really sort of saw the full scope of his involvement. Now, Sam Brownback, one of the most right wing senators, about to become governor of Kansas. Almost unopposed. And so I was just out in Kansas speaking with some, not just Democratic groups, but even Republicans, mainstream Republicans who don't want this crazy right-winger running their state. And they wanted to know exactly that. How can they challenge Sam Brownback? And I think the questions are, one, you want to say, okay, did you live at this C Street house, which has been part of these scandals? Now, Sam Brownback in the past has both said he lived there and said he didn't live there. Well, now that's a point for some tough questions right there. If you lived there, why? Did you report the subsidy that you were accepting from this group as a gift? If you didn't, why? What was the, you talk about getting spiritual counseling from this group. What was the nature of it? You talk about this group helping you make political decisions. How so? How do they engage? Now, Brownback has given some examples. He gave an example, actually, something he teamed up with Joe Pitts on called the Silk Road Act.
wasn't able to pass it yet. So he's still working on it. Silk Road Act, one of these pieces of legislation that no one pays much attention to. Small backroom legislation. What it does is it gives U.S. aid to the dictators of the various Central Asian republics. Brownback's people explained the benefits to me as threefold. One, it helps suppress Islamic radicalism by propping up dictators. Well, I don't quite get the logic there, but that's what they say. Two, it opens these countries up for American investment, American dollars. Now, Brownback's biggest backer happens to be the natural gas giant Koch Industries. They're going to benefit from that. But that's, you know, we don't want to be cynical about it. Maybe that's just coincidence. Number three, he says, where American dollars go, the gospel follows. This is a way to proselytize and evangelize those Muslim nations. Well, I mean, if you can't think of some questions to ask about that piece of legislation, then maybe you're not ready for democracy.
How do people keep track of all the work and the writing you're doing? Do you have, like, an archive in one place? They get the book. You have a website?
Sure. There's jeffcharlotte.com, and, you know, I write a lot for Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stone Magazine. You can sort of follow the stuff. In Salon, I've been doing some writing on sort of the more sort of up-to-the-minute stuff and Daily Beast and all these kinds of things. But, you know, what's been great about this is there's a lot of attention happening elsewhere. So, in fact, it was the Talking Point memo, the Talking Point muckraker, that just yesterday had the scoop that the family's C Street houses had its tax-exempt status revoked because of the reporting that I was doing and working with Rachel Maddow, the Rachel Maddow Show. I mean, basically, if you watch the Rachel Maddow Show, you'll stay up to date on this because she's just been terrific on working with me to keep this story going.
She's been great.
She's really, she's, I think, the strongest person in the mainstream media about this. But there's a lot of folks, there's a lot of local reporters around the country doing this. One of the best investigative reports came from the Daily Newspaper in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They're the ones who discovered that James Inhofe was using taxpayer dollars for his private missionary trips in Kansas. The local TV news in Wichita, no one ever thinks of TV news as great investigators, they started asking tough questions about Congressman Todd Tehart, and they discovered that their other Republican congressman, Jerry Moran, lives in the C Street house. North Carolina, they put Congressman Heath Shuler on the hot spot. Beginning of the summer, he's bragging to Christian Right publications about how he lives in the C Street house. By the end of the summer, when maybe it's not such a good place to be affiliated with, he says he can neither confirm nor deny his residents. Tennessee, the Nashville Tennesseans, doing a terrific job. And yeah, I wanted to say because you're in the Philadelphia area there, you know, there's as I understand it, there's a Democratic challenger to Joe Pitts named Lois Hare, and she's trying to raise these issues. And I know she has read the book, her staff has read the book, she's looking at Joe Pitts' involvement, and I'm not a partisan in terms of politics. I don't register either party, but I do believe in asking these tough questions, and so folks there can team up with her to really confront Joe Pitts and make some democracy.
Lois Harris, great. I met her a couple years ago, and I just saw her this summer at the Netroots Nation, and she would be a great representative, but it's awful tough. Joe Pitts is really ingrained there into conservative.
Well, there's a fault line there, isn't there? Because as I understand it, Joe Pitts sort of made a deal with the local Republican establishment that he would serve five terms and then he was done, and he would turn it over to a different faction of the Republican Party, and he broke that deal. So I think there's some fault lines there. And I think, you know, another question that I think is worth asking with these guys, and I emphasize this with my friends in Kansas, with looking at Sam Brownback, if you're involved in the family, you tend to get involved in very international affairs. Brownback has been extremely involved in Africa, and in fact I've been looking at his relationship to Uganda right now. Uganda's just about to pass the most violently anti-gay law in the world, the Anti-Homosexuality Act of 2009, death penalty for some gay acts, 7 years prison for some who, if you fail to report a gay or lesbian person. This is a country, by the way, that the United States has given $1.2 billion of aid to.
back, let's just say his heart is in Africa, you know, the question you ask is, okay, that's great. What's it doing there? What is it doing over there? Joe Pitts' heart is in Africa, too. Joe Pitts has been very involved in Uganda. Let's ask tough questions. What is your involvement there? Are you using these countries as guinea pigs for the kind of Christian right policies you would like to implement here in the United States? Are you punishing these developing nations?
You've got me really tying together this organization with the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein talks about. It seems like there's a very close connection. Is there? What's the story there?
Yeah, I think the family invented the shock doctrine. We're going back. We're talking about 1935. I mean, the family, you know, they were neoliberal before anyone can imagine the term. I mean, this is an internationalist group dedicated to laissez-faire economics and the expansion of American power. That is a
they're Friedman people. These are Milton Friedmanites.
Yes.
Have you had any conversations with Naomi Klein? Does she mention the family in her book at all?
No, she doesn't. Look, I would say with tremendous respect, that just the amazing job she's done as a reporter. Religion is a huge blind spot in her work, and I think she comes from a place where I think people are sort of looking at. She's looking at economics and foreign affairs and so on, and assuming that religion is the soft stuff, that it's just a cynical veneer. And I think the reality is, when we look back over American history in the 20th century, we have to recognize that religion played a big part in forming the ideology. And it does more than that, because, you know, there are a few guys out there like Dick Cheney and maybe the late Richard Nixon. They didn't need to tell themselves they were good guys. They were going to do what they were doing. They were true, you know, hearts of darkness, realpolitik guys. But most of these politicians, Sam Brownback, Tom Coburn, James Inhofe, Chuck Grassley, they need to feel like they're doing the right thing. And this is the ideology that allows them to believe that they're doing the right thing. It's also the ideology that allows them to make a lot of connections. So, I think that's a blind spot in Naomi Klein's otherwise just stunningly invaluable work. You can read my book, but there's plenty of other books out there, too, that are also looking at these issues. Jeremy Gunn has got a book called Spiritual Weapons about the role fundamentalism played in foreign policy in the Cold War and shaping the world we live in now. There's a terrific little book called Serving God in Walmart, by Bethany Morton, just out. And it's about Walmart, obviously, and how they use religion, but it's also looking at sort of international economics and how capitalism and Christianity get conflated into this biblical capitalism that becomes really the handmaiden to imperial power.
It just seems like the family could grease the skids so easily for the corporate and political people that Naomi Klein describes. It just seems
the same people. I mean, that's what I'm saying is the blind spot in Naomi's work. They're the same people. The family isn't greasing the skids for them. They are those people. I mean, you know, you look at how does Chuck Colson get involved in the family? Doug Coe says, let's get this guy Chuck Colson involved. He goes to his good friend Tom Phillips, then the CEO of Raytheon, the defense contractor, longtime family member, and says, why don't you reach out to Chuck? And Colson describes this in his memoir, Born Again, having these long, weepy sessions with the CEO of Raytheon. You know, you talk about one of the things I've been looking at with the C-Street scandals this summer hasn't been talked about. Congressman Chip Pickering, former congressman from Mississippi, has an affair in the C Street House, he's having an affair with the heiress to the Cellular South fortune. He leaves Congress to become a lobbyist for her, in which capacity he starts working with another resident of the C Street House, former Congressman Steve Largent, who is now the head of the biggest wireless lobbying association. They team up with another family man named Jim Slattery, Democrat, right-wing Democrat from Kansas, who's become a big lobbyist, and start spreading the money around. And when we look at the whole net neutrality fight, you look down, boom, 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 the guys who are in that fight, it's all Family Guys. And these are the guys who are involved in that kind of big communications technology, and that, which is a real big part of globalization. Now, oil, oil has been a mainstay of the families going back to the 1950s. So it really is the same people. What I'm saying in my book, The Family, I think is complementing what Naomi Klein is saying in The Shock Doctrine. And as we think about how we're going to fight back, I think we need to have as deep an understanding of these forces as we can.
So fighting back, because, I mean, it seems to me we have this group of tens of thousands of people with the 10% of the Congress that is really threatening our democracy and attempting to do horrible things. And has your work so far produced, besides the loss of their tax-exempt status, anything that you can note that has taken them down a peg or cost them anything? Or How's it looking so far? A little bit.
You know, one of my favorite stories is a very unlikely one. In Norway, of all places, when I first read about this Harper's Magazine, some Norwegian reporters noticed it. And Norway, this very liberal nation, had just elected its first socially conservative government in many years. Now, as it happens, I'd met their prime minister, Bondevik, who'd come around to the family's Arlington headquarters while I was there. These guys sort of paid attention to this. They noticed that their new right-wing prime minister was jetting around the world going to these private prayer sessions on the taxpayer's dime. And so they did what reporters are supposed to do. They investigated. They sent a team over to the United States. They discovered that the new right-wing Norwegian ambassador was holding regular meetings at the family's headquarters with John Ashcroft. They discovered that, in fact, this whole right-wing movement in Norwegian politics had been getting advice and help from the family going back 10 years. They put it all on the front page of the newspaper. It was Norwegian Watergate, and that government fell. That collapsed. That's how it's supposed to work. United States, a little bit slower. I think NBC News, when they did this, they thought they had the scoop of the year, and they got no traction on it. And I think that had a lot to do last year with, frankly, the religious illiteracy of liberals and progressives and secular folks who really want to believe that fundamentalists are just hillbillies. They don't want to accept the fact that, hey, wait a minute, you're dealing with a sophisticated, educated, affluent, wealthy movement. These are not the Beverly Hillbillies. These are real people who are, you got to get in there and have a real democratic fight with them. You can't just dismiss them. But there are, when you do that, you can have successes. I look at another example, Senator Mark Pryor down in Arkansas. 2 years ago, I called him up to interview him for another story about Rolling Stone, a Christian right organization that claimed his allegiance. He said, no, I don't really work with them. I actually work with this other group, and I said, you know, family. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, that's interesting because, you know, you're kind of conservative Democrat, but you're Democrat. And he says, well, through the family, I learned the meaning of bipartisanship is that Jesus did not come to take sides. He came to take over. Well, I used that quote. Senator Pryor, this summer, when all the scandals broke, suddenly he doesn't want to be linked to the family anymore. And he has his people tell the Arkansas press that I never interviewed him. And so I said, well, all right, that's great. I have the transcript. I'm going to Rachel Maddow tonight, and we can play this. Do you care to make a correction? And, of course, they did. But they said, look, could you just please stop connecting the senator to the family? He doesn't want anything to do with him anymore. That's good. You know, I wish he'd done it in a more honest way, but if he's, hey, this is not a healthy association, this is not a good place for spiritual counseling. And I should add, by the way, there's nothing wrong with congressmen praying together. That's fine. I have no issue with that. I have no issue with faith in public life.
It's when they identify their heroes as Pol Pot and Hitler.
It's when they fetishize strength. It's when they fetishize strength, you know.
We're down to, like, 2 minutes left now. Do they have any connection with Israel? What's the connection with Israel?
Well, that's an interesting case. Israel, the formation of Israel was actually one of the first